For Bird Note, I'm Ariana Rimmel.
We're from the Kiwassa Preteen Spring Camp. You're listening to CJSF 90.1 FM, Campus Community Radio from Simon Fraser University on Burnaby Mountain.
Sangi la.
Kwe.
Why eat beats nak seal?
Tan she.
Tanet e. Negad dakote.
This is Words and Culture, a series on Indigenous languages, funded by SiriusXM through the Community Radio Fund of Canada.
Kwe, Nindeluizi Pam Palmiter. Hi, I'm Pam Palmiter, and I'm your host for the Mi'kmaq episodes of Words and Culture. I'm a member of Eel River Bar First Nation in New Brunswick. In the Mi'kmaq language, we refer to my community as Ugbaganjig, which really refers to the sandbar where the Eel River meets the Bay of Chaleur. Today, we're going to be visiting one of my favorite Wolastoqiyik cousins, Jeremy Dutcher. Our two nations, the Mi'kmaq and Wolastoqiyik, sit side by side in New Brunswick. Since time immemorial, we've always had a good relationship as allies and trading partners. Jeremy Dutcher is a two-time Polaris Prize winner, the only person in the history of the awards to win it twice. His music has defined a whole new genre. I love how he uses the Wolastoqiyik language to pay homage to his ancestors. His first album, Wolastoqiyik, Lindawa Gonua, saw him using wax cylinder recordings from his community. His second album, Modawalonuuk, is a remarkable blend of cultural depth and musical innovation. While out on tour, Jeremy brings with him a language learning book so he can practice his Wolastoqiyik language while on the road. Why didn't I think of that? Here we go. This is Jeremy Dutcher.
Kwep sidewen, ntliwi, spigwidwi a jiplage, nduje o negut kuk, wabanaki kuk. Naga bemigiskak, which in duwe on nidabesk pampometer, naga Banff Center, dege. So I just said in my language, my name is Jeremy. I come from the East Wabanaki territory. Mi'kmaq, Wabanaki, we're all related, we're all connected. But now I'm talking to my new friend here, Pam, at the Banff Center for the Arts in these sacred mountains. So two friends from the East.
Yeah, it's so amazing. And we used to call your First Nation Tobik First Nation, but now... Now, what do they refer to themselves as?
Well, and in my intro, I said Nugutkuk, which means that place where the rivers are coming together. So it's always a better descriptor than a French word, you know? We're taking our languages back, which I think is a really powerful moment. And even in how we call ourselves, you know, the people of the beautiful river, Wolastoqiyik. It's something that's changed even in my lifetime. Like when I was a kid, we were called Maliseet, which is actually, when you dig into the roots of that word, it's a Mi'kmaq word that talks about the slow talkers or the bad talkers, just because our languages are kind of pretty close. So I think it's important for us to sit in our names and really claim that, because it's good for our international relations, you know, to meet each other in a real authentic way of where we come from and the names that we carry and stand. So yeah, you know, Maliseet Nation used to be called Tobik First Nation, but now we say Wolastoq and Negutkuk, which is closer to how we speak about ourselves. So I think it's a powerful moment of renaming and reshaping this country to closer reflect the realities of how people actually speak about themselves and how we identify.
I like our names for ourselves better anyway. I mean, the ways in which other people name us never just get it quite right. And can I just say, I am so excited that I get to talk to the Jeremy Dutcher, and not just about random things, but about language and culture, because I am such a huge fan of your music and appreciate that it's this amazing combination of unique music, but also language and culture. And I think those two things married together is just perfect.
That weaving together, or that marriage like you talked about, I think is, we can't separate out language from music, because our language is music, you know, and it's land music. Our elders said that that our languages, they come from this place. They only live here and they spring from the land. And, you know, just a couple quick examples, too, of how our languages really are listening to the land as well. So, for example, our term for a salmon going in is kind of the sound it makes when it goes into the water. So balam, balam. You know, it's got this, it's got, or like the our word for crow, gakagus, is the sound that it's making, you know? So there's this intrinsic naturedness to our languages that I think is specific and located to where we come from. Yeah, I think for me, when I started to think about music and putting my own work out into the world, it had to be from our language, you know, perspective, because that's when we introduce ourselves, we start in our way. And I think it's important to introduce ourselves in our way and yes, to translate and to invite people into that and to welcome people still, but really be strong in ourselves. And so for me, there was no question when I set to make my first album called Wolastoqwiiglintuaganuwa, which means the songs of the people of the beautiful river. There was no translations, you know, and I didn't really feel like it needed it, because for me, it's about who we direct our work towards. And for me, my music was always about language and revitalization. You know, I think artists and scholars and thinkers, they're all problem solvers. So for me, a real problem was that, you know, when I was growing up, when I was coming up, we couldn't go and turn on the radio and hear our language. Like, our language was not accessible. And if you didn't grow up in a family that spoke, how do you learn? And there's many ways to do it, obviously through projects like immersion schools, through, you know, classes and apps and all of these different technologies that are keeping our language strong. But for me, I think like music is a real thread that we can weave across all of those different disciplines, and also between our nations as well. Like, some of the first songs that I learned from my Passamaquoddy music teacher were Mi'kmaq songs. And so, you know, it's like that kind of collectivity as Wabanaki'ik, I think is important to reaffirm all the time.
So way, way back in the day, I studied Mi'kmaq and Wolastoqwe languages in university from elder speakers, and it was amazing. But there's one word I mix up all the time, and I can't tell which version of the word I'm supposed to be using, and I'm sure you know what I'm talking about. There's Wolastoqwe, Wolastoqwewi, Wolastoqwe'ik, and what is what? What's the difference between all of these?
Every time I talk about my music to newcomers or to even our own people, you know, breaking down our words, because we, as Indigenous people, we have these big, long, beautiful words, what's called like a polymorphic way of building words. And so you take a root verb and you're building on either side relational information or time-space information. So I like to break it down like this. Wolastoq is the like root, right? That word is in all of those three words. So that's the kind of simplest form of the word. And Wolastoq, it's talking about the river. So all our territory runs basically from the Gulf of St. Lawrence all down through Maine and New Brunswick and into the ocean near St. John, Manakwes, as we call it. And so our territory is the river. We are the river people. And so we take that word Wolastoq and we put suffixes, we put endings onto the word to describe things about the river. So Wolastoq is the river. Some people know it as the St. John River, but I don't know who St. John is. Most people in New Brunswick don't know who St. John is either. So we're calling it Wildestuk. She has her name back, and we're very happy about that. But you add the Gwe onto it, and that's actually talking about our language. Mm-hmm. So Wildestuk Gwe language is how we would say it. Some people also use that as a personal one-person suffix. So you might say Wildestuk Gwe, I am a Wildestuk person. But when we talk about people, like the people, like Wildestuk Nation, we say Wildestuk Wiig, and the Iig is that really beautiful ending that talks about, because we don't break up the world in gender, right? Like a lot of European languages, they say, oh, you know, the table is this and the window is that, you know, we use feminine gender and masculine gender. We don't have time for that. We figured out something better, which is, does it live? Does it contain life? Or is it, you know, something else? And so we have this system of animate and inanimate. And so that word, Wildestuk Wiig, and the Iig is talking about the people, the animate. We are the people of that river. But here's where it gets interesting. How we talk about trees is very similar. So, for example, one tree is abis. But if we talk about a group of trees, we say abiziig, and it's the same ending. And so those are not just trees. Those are the tree people. Those are our tree relatives. And in this light, I think we can start to think about how Indigenous language reshapes our mind and reshapes our relationship to the natural world, right? Because we start to imbue the natural world with a life form that English doesn't, that French doesn't, that pretty much no other language is doing that. You know, it's really unique to where we come from and who we are. So I think it's a celebration. I think we need to be encouraging all the time our young people and all of our people, really, to look to our language and to think about it as, because I think it can be daunting too for people that are coming back to that and trying to revitalize that in their own life. And I get it. You know, it's been my road too. But I, as soon as I started to understand language as less of a task and more as a gift that you get to unwrap, every day is like a new layer of that gift, and it's a new teaching, and it's a new understanding, and it really changes your heart and your mind. And for me, that entering to that work from that place becomes something exciting and something you want to take on and that you want to share with everybody you meet. Like just something like this, the tree people thing, I think I've told this to three people already today. You know what I'm saying? It's, you know, you just, it's a gift you want to keep sharing, and gifts aren't ours to hold, right? Like when we're given something, it needs to go out in the world, because then it amplifies. So yes, more language.
Well, Leewin, thank you so much for helping me actually try to get it straight. And honestly, just talking about this, like trees as people, oh, that makes my heart so happy, because how often do we treat living things as something other than where we are? So I really, really love that. And I can hear the passion in your voice for the Wildestuk Gwe language. And we know that Indigenous languages all over Turtle Island, North America, are endangered, all of them. But your language in particular is in a special predicament. Can you talk a little bit about why it's so urgent to address the Wildestuk Gwe language?
Yes, I'm so happy to talk about this. And I'm glad the passion comes through my voice, because I do feel this is my life work, is to help lift up this movement of revitalization and to put light with this little platform that I have based on my music, to really point out that there's a community of people that are doing that work. And you know, I think all the time, my whole life, you know, it's been thinking about language and trying to understand the precarity of our language, like why it is in the place that it's in. And, you know, as soon as I started to connect the dots of colonization and, you know, the school system and the ways that it violently let our people down, and even the ways that we lost the value of our own language, we even stopped believing it. But it was shocking to me when I first understood both the numbers, you know, of how many speakers we actually have. And when you sit to, when you sit down, and we actually did this a couple months ago, we sat down, and the community that, you know, that my family comes from, we have the most amount of speakers left. And we sat down and wrote out every single person we know that speaks the language. There's only 30 in that community. So, you know, even there's number. And here's the thing. I think we can get caught in numbers, and they can bury us before we're even past, you know, and the stories that we tell about us. I think there's this balance between like inciting urgency and making people understand, like, no. Like, this is the generation that the work needs to happen. And we need to fight really, really hard to preserve what we have left, which is, you know, communities of speakers. People still, like, were raised in this language. Like, this is, you know, we can tell the story of language death, you know, and that's one that the media and that Canada is very comfortable talking about. And maybe less so about language life and all that critical work that's happening. Like, we just in our community, we just released a dictionary like last week. We have, and this is a dictionary that's created by a family of speakers. You know, there's all these projects that are happening on the ground that don't look anything like death to me. Like, I'm so lucky. I guess because I'm working in this language space, I get to come around a lot of amazing elders and people that have been committed to that work for a long time. So, for example, last year I went and I lived with a 94-year-old named Henrietta Black, and she's the oldest living speaker of our language. She came to one of my shows and kind of like heckled me a little bit from the crowd. And then after, I was like, somebody's heckled me in my language. That's a new one. And she came up after, she says, "Why do you talk like that? You don't really talk like us too well." Because she, and what I realized is, oh, because I was trained and taught by a Passamaquoddy. And so I kind of talk, and it's the same language, but I kind of talk like them. I use their accent a little bit. And so she picked up on it, and she was like, no, you got to learn to talk our way. You're going to come and live in my house for 2 months, and I'm only going to speak language to you.
You know, wow.
I was like, I can't pass up an invitation like that. I don't have 2 free months, unfortunately, but I have 3 weeks. And so I went for 3 weeks, and I sat in her home. And all's to say, our languages still live, you know, and we can't put the nail in the coffin. And, you know, sitting down and hearing her gossip with her friend every night in our language, and her just being like, come sit, you're going to listen. You know, like, those were such, you know, to understand that language is sacred and it's beautiful, but it also needs to live in secular spaces and like kind of profane spaces and like spaces that we don't think of as sacred because it opens it up to people that don't feel like they can hold the sacred or haven't been invited into that yet, you know? So I think language is that pathway in. Because when you start to engage our languages, you start to understand that, oh, there's a whole different starting place than an English starting place. And when, you know, when languages start from different places, they get to very different conclusions, and they value different things. And so in my mind, as much as, you know, that's our work for us to get strong and us to engage our languages and speak in the way that our ancestors spoke,
I love that, this whole concept that language is living, it's alive, there's meaning in the language, our laws and culture are in the language. It's not just about individual words. And I think one of the things that you've said that just has given me so much hope today is that we always talk about language death. I can rattle off all of the colonial laws and policies and practices that have done everything to erase us. But how often do we talk about language life? And I think that's where things blossom from. Like, just hearing you say that, just that other perspective makes me think, okay, I need to shift my perspective on language, because it is a journey when you didn't grow up fluent, like I didn't grow up fluent. So, and one of the things I think about as an educator is where our youth are. So let's just say they live in a house like I did, and people weren't speaking the Mi'kmaq language, you know, lots of reasons for that. And where are youth today? Well, we know that they are big consumers of things like podcasts and YouTube and music. And I think, gosh, of all of the impediments that we have to reach our youth, what amazes me about you is that you said, well, you know what? Instead of demanding that they come to us, I am going to meet them where they're at. And where they're at, this like music and love of music in our culture, you make sure to include that. And I'd love to hear more about what made you think to specifically incorporate the Wolastoqiyi language, because if you talk to branding experts, they like, oh, you need some one word and something simple, easy to remember, something that someone can type on a computer. And you're like, no, this is what the title's going to be. And to have done the work, I just don't know of any other musical compilation that is doing all of these things: language, the voices of our ancestors, the teachings, reaching our kids where they're at. What made you kind of design your album this way? Because I'm just fascinated.
My real answer is like, it's your bundle. What you create is comprised of everything you're carrying. And so when I set out to make that first record, it actually started as a conversation in a kitchen, as many things do. Maggie Paul, who is a very cherished elder and song carrier from out in the East Coast, and I was very, very lucky to be mentored by her and to be in her lodge. You know, it was what she shared with me that set me on the path to be a creator. And to understand that you know, you're either creating or destructing. Something like music can only be created in beauty. And that lesson kind of, it hit hard, it kind of struggled with it a little bit, because there's a lot of unbeautiful music. And yet she says, no. It's about the act of offering. That's where the beauty is. It's not necessarily in what you're hearing. It's about the fact that somebody is comfortable enough, actualized enough, in a good space enough to share their song. So these kind of things, like these kind of philosophies, came through that kind of like one-on-one intergenerational mentorship. That's what set me on a path to like, to really start to dig into who we are. People don't know what a secret nerd I am, because this all started as an academic paper, as my thesis. I was going around talking. I wanted to do, well, first of all, at Dalhousie, there was no ethnomusicology program. There was, you could do music or you could do anthropology. And I was like, well, I want to do both. When what you see in the world is not to your liking, and what you don't see out there, you vision, you got to go create it. You got to go create it and share it with people. So I went around and started talking with our song carriers, and I wanted to know, how has music changed in your life? And so in those conversations, I got a really, really strong insight to the kind of sonic history of our communities, and how the American Indian movement, kind of returning to ourselves more broadly in that time, really changed song. And how songs work on the East Coast. So, for example, a lot of the elders said, "Well, we didn't have any Indian music when I was growing up. I didn't hear that, you know." But it started, you know, around the 70s, you know, and we brought the drum back. But in that conversation with Maggie, she says, "But if you want to know about the old songs, you got to go to the museum." And I said, "Well, what do you mean the museum?" She's like, "That's where the old songs live." And what she was talking about was a set of field recordings or ancestor recordings that were taken in between 1907 and 1914 by this guy named William Meshling, this anthropologist. And he went and recorded our ancestors. He actually lived among our people for like almost 7 years and collected songs, stories, clothing, like did the whole thing. You know, coming from a problematic place, because I think the understanding at that time was, oh, Native people are dying, their culture is dying, and so we need to go see how long this death narrative has been following us around. And so that was the idea. That's where it came from. They wanted to collect our stuff before they disappeared us. And yet here we stand, and here we sing, and here we speak. So fundamentally, it has to be a celebration, the resilience of that. You know, and what I heard when I first heard those from over 100 years ago, those voices kind of reaching out and speaking and saying and singing and laughing and dancing, you could hear it all on those recordings. It's so incredible. It's like a real snapshot. And so for me, I just wanted to go and share that and to find a way to contextualize that archive, because it's, you know, when you listen to the original recordings, they're from over 100 years ago. They were done on wax cylinders, and so it's really scratchy. There's kind of this obscured nature to them, and yet for me as like a music nerd, I was like, what a beautiful piece of culture. So it was about contextualizing those old songs in a way that you could meet people. And thank you for bringing up the young people too, because it was absolutely a part of my consideration around like building this project and trying to offer something that would connect with people. Which is to say, it wasn't about, you know, dumbing things down or making them simple or, you know, using it, trying to make a pop record. No, I made my weird classical fusion kind of in between thing. And in the hopes that would meet people too, and be nourishing music for their spirit too.
That was the incredible Jeremy Dutcher. I could have spoken to him for hours and hours. There is something so special about Jeremy. He's wise for his young age. I really appreciate how he makes space for our people who are reconnecting with their cultures or trying hard to learn their language. Waliwan, thank you. In Mi'kmaq, we say Walalan for thank you, but in Wolastoqiyik, we say Waliwan, thank you. You don't want to miss out on our next show. It's going to be so eye-opening. You'll see the Mi'kmaq language in a totally different way. So until next time, Waliwan, thank you. I'm Pam Palmiter for Words and Culture.
Words and Culture is made possible with funding from SiriusXM through the Community Radio Fund of Canada. Words and Culture is produced by Kim Wheeler. Kaylin Belair is our audio engineer and editor.
Hausin dan King Sam.
Nimaltis.
Ninuis ahaha mi ku kwakwal.
Kachu nautano.
Wapamatin mi na.
You are now tuned into CJSF 90.1 FM, broadcasting from Burnaby, BC. Want to know more about the channel? Find us online at cjsf.ca.
Bird Note. Author Christian Cooper is never not birding, even at the movies. Like when he was watching the 2006 film Apocalypto, an action thriller set in what is now Mexico during the Mayan Empire.
And so they show a river, and they show a cattle egret at the river. And I'm like, nope, no good. And a lot of people would say, no, there are cattle egrets in Mesoamerica. And that's correct. There are cattle egrets in Mesoamerica. Now.
Western cattle egrets are common birds on several continents today, but they're originally from Africa. The birds weren't found in the Americas until the late 1800s, possibly because they were blown off course during migration.
For me, that's a perfect metaphor of the African diaspora experience, that we people of African descent, you know, got dragged across the ocean by no fault of our own, and yet here we are, and we found a way to thrive and live here and make our way here, just like the cattle egret. So to me, the cattle egret is the spirit of Black lives set loose into the air. So I just love the cattle egret.
Hear more stories about birds on screen in Season 8 of Bring Birds Back, available in your favorite podcast app and on our website, birdnote.org. I'm Joni Franklin.